London, the National Broadcasting Company presents War Telescope, a review of the war week and a forecast of possible developments to come. War Telescope features John McVain of NBC's London staff. For his regular Saturday report, we take you now to NBC London.
This is John McVain in London. Less than an hour ago, it was announced here that a strong force of American fortresses and liberators today bombed the aircraft factories in Brunswick, Germany, and aerodromes in the northwestern part of the country. It's estimated that between 500 and 750 heavy bombers and 500 escorting fighters took part in the raid. Brunswick has already been heavily bombed, and it's probable that today's attack was chiefly to stop rebuilding in what was once one of Germany's chief centers for producing Luftwaffe fighters. Lord Beaverbrook and Mr. Burley held a news conference for press and radio representatives today. They discussed the preliminary civil aviation talks they've been holding. It was announced that both sides had to make concessions, and United States and Russian officials are going to meet, probably in Washington. Both British and American seem determined that no German or Japanese air carriers will be allowed to operate after the war. It was said there must be standardization of international air operations, and equality of competition must be maintained in international air traffic. I've talked about civil aviation with experts here. They believe that differences between America and Britain can be solved very rapidly. One chief problem remains for the International Air Conference of the Allies. Many nations will have a valid plane to run their own international airlines. Belgium, Holland, and France, for instance, must link up with their distant empires. Russia covers the immense stretch of the Baltic to the Pacific with her own territory, and it would seem likely that she'll take as large a part in international aviation as any of the other nations. British experts feel it would be suicidal for nations to throw all routes open to unrestricted competition, for the volume of post-war air traffic, even in the most optimistic estimates, couldn't support, say, a dozen different transatlantic lines. If that theory is taken for granted, an international air conference will have to limit the carriers on the different air routes, form the various links with the subsidiary lines, and bring order into a question that affects the entire world's communications. Without some sort of international scheme, it's thought nations would be running heavily subsidized air transport over the world's chief routes just for the sake of prestige and whether they lost money badly or not. I've seen reports of public men at home claiming that because we've built air bases in various parts of the world, we therefore have the right to keep them after the war and use them as civilian air transport terminals. It's only fair to say that the impression abroad is that we built the bases to help win the war, not as a means of extending post-war air transport. But the coming international conference will probably clarify thinking on the whole subject. You've heard the Allied air attacks on Germany and the occupied countries described as the prelude to invasion, the necessary preliminary weakening of an opponent's strength, so he'll be less able to stand up under a combined land, sea, and air attack on Western Europe. There's another kind of preliminary work that had to be done before the weight of the continent could be cleared, cripple his sea power. German sea power meant two things, submarines and the two great battleships, Scharnhorst and Tirpitz. Against submarines, the combined navies and air forces of Britain and America have been waging bitter and successful war. The strength of the German U-boat packs has been broken, if not shattered completely. The resistance they can offer to invasion convoys is not important. There remain the two battleships. Hidden up in the fjords of northern Norway, they could strike northward against our convoys to Russia, or southward against a second front armada of troop transports and landing craft. In theory, a single German battleship could blow to bits a convoy protected only by cruisers and destroyers. Only battleships, her own class, could stand up and slug it out with her. You know how this preliminary work, removing the menace of the German battleships, was accomplished. How the British home fleet caught and sank the Scharnhorst a few weeks ago. How last fall, British midget submarines crippled the Tirpitz with torpedoes and put her out of action for months. But those winter months of darkness, gales, and snow blizzards made further attacks impossible, and covered repair ships slipping up through the Norwegian islands. The Tirpitz had to be kept out of action, action especially at the crucial moment of invasion. You've heard that British naval aircraft, many of them made in American factories, took on the great job of keeping the Tirpitz out of the war. Today, I've brought Commander Anthony Kimmins of the British Navy, who was on one of the aircraft carriers, to give a first-hand impression of the action. Commander, why was the decision taken to use naval planes flying from aircraft carriers rather than, say, midget submarines again or land-based bombers?
Well, midget submarines couldn't be expected to succeed a second time. You see, they depend on sheer impertinence, audacity, and complete surprise. The enormous distance to the North Cape, the northernmost point in Europe, ruled out the use of shore-based heavy bombers. No, the only answer was naval dive bombers and fighter escorts operating from aircraft carriers.
And what kind of weather did you meet?
On the day of the attack itself, the weather was unbelievably good. But during the first part of the passage up north and way up into the Arctic Circle, the weather got colder and bitterer every day. And when the wind flow over the flight deck is a 40-mile-an-hour snow blizzard, and the spray breaking over the forecastle is freezing before it touches down, those flight deck parties on an aircraft carrier have one of the toughest jobs imaginable. The pilots sighed with relief when, just before dawn on the day they were to attack, they found perfect conditions, calm sea and a clear sky with patches of cloud. On the flight deck, engines roared. The carriers and the escorting ships were all heeling over, swinging into the wind. As the steam jet up in the bows, to show when the ship is dead into the wind, was opened up, lumps of ice shot into the air, went slithering down the flight deck, got whirled up in the propeller slipstreams, and was sent cracking against the flight deck crews, clinging to the wingtips and lying on the deck, tending the chocks. The planes roared away over the bows one by one. Nearby, you could see the same thing going on. British Fairey Barracuda dive bombers, used for the first time in action, sea fires, and the American Vostochny Corsair and Grumman Wildcat and Hellcat fighters.
I expect they made quite a sight forming up over your head.
Indeed they did. The sky seemed filled with them, all heading for Norway. As they gained height and crossed the coast, the sun was rising to their left, shining across the snow-covered mountains, throwing shadows into the gorges and against the snow-covered trees in the valleys, and lighting up the deep blue of the calm fjord. Down to the left were two or three enemy ships, but these took no visible interest in the proceedings. Everything seemed calm and peaceful. But I'll bet that up at the far end of the fjord, alarm bells were ringing, fat-headed Huns were falling out of bed, rubbing their eyes and cursing the British as they threw on some clothes and stumbled out to their cold action stations.
Did the aircraft meet any opposition?
No enemy fighters came up. But as they neared the target, a flagship further out in the fjord opened up, but rather raggedly and without any great effect. And then, as they crossed the final ridge, there, nestling under the sheer mountains, in the narrow fjord, lay one of the largest battleships in the world, the Tirpitz, a dark wisp of smoke coming up from her funnel. Up till then, the strike had kept dead radio silence. Now, a sudden rasping noise hit them in the ears. The leader had switched on. Then a shout. All fighters anti-flak. Leader over.
How did the attack begin?
Hellcats and wildcats literally fell out of the sky. As the barracudas hurtled down, they could see the fighters strafing the surrounding gun positions and whistling across the Tirpitz, with the tracers from their bullets bouncing off her deck. Green and red tracer came racing up, but the fighters had entirely disorganized her AA fire, and the barracudas were able to take perfect aim. Down they went with their eyes glued to her funnel. 6,000, 5,000, 4,000. They went down so fast that anything loose shot up to the roof of the cockpits. Now the leader was at the right height, and he let go. The first three bombs went whistling down, exploding bang on her bridge, the nerve center of the ship. The other pilots diving from either side were close in his tail. One extra large bomb, bursting through the armor plate amidships, went off with a terrific explosion between decks. The huge ship shuddered, her stern whipping up and down and sending waves across the fjord. You know, the whole attack was so beautifully synchronized, so beautifully timed, that it was only 60 seconds, just 1 minute, from the first bomb to the last.
Did the second attack come in fast?
As the first strike weaved away and made off down the valleys, with fires raging in the Tirpitz and the artificial smoke cover belching out from all around her, they saw above them the second strike coming in from the sea. Admittedly, the artificial smoke and the smoke from the first strike's explosions helped guide them to the target. But by the time they got over, the whole fjord was almost completely obscured, with a strong box barrage above the smoke. But luckily, at the critical moment, the smoke cleared over the Tirpitz, and with a shout of joy, they roared down, carrying out similar tactics and doing probably an equal amount of damage. Again, there were many hits. One heavy bomb in particular was seen to crash through the upper deck and explode with a sheet of flame that reached above the topmast, the cloud of smoke going up to over 1,500 feet. And by the time the last pilot dived, the AA fire had ceased.
And so naval aircraft, in a few minutes over the target, left the Tirpitz crippled once more.
Yes, and as we steamed south for home and messages of congratulation came pouring in, you know, I couldn't help thinking of a small group in a German prisoner of war camp. the crews of those midget submarines. I'll bet when they hear the good news, they'll get a bigger kick than anyone.
And I'll bet they'll get a real thrill out of it, Commander. Thank you for telling us the story. I said that the British naval aircraft helped accomplish a preliminary phase of the invasion, wrecking German sea power. There's another phase of invasion that's also of vital importance, the cooperation of the underground forces in the occupied countries. President Roosevelt is reported to have mentioned recently the difficulty of knowing the opinion of the people inside France. In the light of this, it may be interesting to know some of the ideas of an extremely intelligent Frenchwoman who arrived here recently. Unfortunately, she doesn't speak English, so I couldn't bring her today to the microphone. Madame Aubrac was the heroine of the exploit you probably heard about. She rescued her husband from the Gestapo while he was on his way to execution. She led a group of the men of the Marquis and only came out of France because she was about to have her second child. It was born 2 or 3 days after she reached England. Madame Aubrac is less like your idea of a gunwoman than anyone you could meet. She looks like what she is, an intelligent schoolteacher. She emphasizes that for the great bulk of the patriots, life must be lived on two planes, the secret and the open. While they're sabotaging and working against the Germans and their Vichy assistants, most of them are also living quite ordinary lives so the Germans don't suspect them. Madame Aubrac, for instance, was a teacher. When she came in the morning and found some slogan like Vive de Gaulle chalked on the blackboard, she tried to find and punish the child who'd done it. Her efforts and her scoldings were cover for her own far more important activities. They satisfied officials that she was what she seemed to be, an ordinary schoolteacher, most interested in keeping her job. She fought openly among the men of the Marquis before she came to England, but that was after she'd rescued her husband from death. The resistance movements, she says, are extremely well organized now. The communists played the largest part at the very beginning, for they were the best organized for underground warfare. Now, however, they make up only 20 or 30% of the resistance organizations. Madame Aubrac thinks that's a fair indication of their importance in post-war France, but she doesn't believe that even the communists think France will become communist. The resistance movement has become highly integrated within France, and Madame Aubrac says they all recognize the French committee in Algiers as the present government of France, but there's no adulation of General de Gaulle. The resistance movements regard him as the symbol of France's fight for freedom and as the head of the government, but she laughs at the idea of France accepting de Gaulle as a dictator. Only a tiny handful of Frenchmen are now convinced collaborators of the Germans. Some of the big industrial class who collaborated with the Germans are now worried about the future. In some cases, however, big industrialists, whom she named, have remained staunch patriots, working against the Germans while putting up an outward show of collaboration. Some of the high Vichy officials, she thought, are trying to contact the Allies as a method of saving their own skins. But Madame Aubrac says they're leaders without troops and represent only themselves. One point she brought out was that the Catholic Church in France is strongly anti-German. At the beginning, the church supported Pétain as the avowed proponent of ancient Catholic virtues. At least 2 years ago, however, the church, under the influence of the Jesuits and Dominicans, realized that Vichy had failed. Since then, the bishops and archbishops, as well as the parish priests, have exerted strong influence against the Germans and on behalf of the new French Republic. Madame Aubrac noted especially the way Catholic Church authorities had opposed German and Vichy persecution of the Jews. This is John McVane in London, sending you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
You have been listening to War Telescope, a weekly report on the war as seen from London by John McVane, NBC's veteran observer in the British capital. Mr. McVane is presented each Saturday at this time over most of these stations. This is the National Broadcasting Company.